I want to introduce you now to Dia Dynasty, a professional dominatrix in New York City. Hey, Dia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Anita. Thank you for having me on.
So this has been a really emotional couple of weeks for a lot of people. I'd love to just start by checking in with you. How are you doing?
I'm actually recovering from the massive emotional and mental drain that was a couple weeks ago. And, you know, feeling a lot of support, but also a lot of collective grief, a lot of mixed emotions, a lot of unpacking still. So being able to kind of space out all of the processing and being able to talk about it is very valuable. Thank you.
Of course. I'm glad to hear that. So I want to talk a bit more about what we heard in the testimony from Sammy about this deliberation that's going on about whether or not some of the victims were sex workers. We don't know whether they would have considered themselves sex workers, and conflating massage work with sex work is imprecise and inaccurate, and we're going to get into that later in the show. But this incident has made folks in the sex work community feel especially vulnerable and targeted. And I'd love to get your thoughts on that. Why do you think it's important to have a conversation about sex work in this time?
Absolutely. Well, sex work is one of the oldest professions, and it's a part of our lives as sex workers to be able to provide this as a service, and so therefore it is work to us. A lot of us have chosen this kind of work, and it is a kind of work that gives us a lot of freedom and flexibility, especially for those of us that are perhaps disabled or don't have the kind of status in this country to be able to get any other kind of job, and allows us a lot of autonomy. And so because it is work that we choose, and, you know, conflating that with sex trafficking, which is work that we don't choose, the conversation is often confused as to who is choosing it and who is not choosing it. And I think that those who side with the victims of sex trafficking are ignoring a huge majority of people who choose consensual sex work, and how we actually are empowered in this work to, you know, to express our autonomy, to express our individualism, to express ourselves as sexual beings, and to, in creating that example, allowing other people to also find the freedom to express themselves as sexual beings, which I think is just like extremely important just in life in general as a human being.
What kind of work do you do? Tell us a bit about it.
I am a professional dominatrix. Under the umbrella of sex work, I do not provide a full spectrum of sexual services, which means that there is no penetration of my body. And what I provide more so than anything is a safe space for people who move through society within their expected gender roles and who need a place to get away from that. So, for example, a cisgendered heteronormative man who wants to experience maybe something like cross-dressing, and maybe doesn't have a place for that. You know, he definitely feels the shame and the stigma of other people who see that and don't like it, or think that it's like weak or gay or whatever. It's neither of those things. And to be able to have a safe space to explore this part of yourself, that is extremely important, so that it doesn't become some oppressed thing that is expressed, you know, sideways as violence. It's a very healthy form of engagement.
I'm talking with Dia Dynasty about sex and sex work discrimination today on Embodied. So you described feeling a lot of agency in the work that you do. And we're going to get a little bit more into the conversation of this kind of dichotomy between choice and coercion and what gets left out when we think about sex work that way. But in this current moment, when there is a renewed conversation about sex work and sex work organizing, How do you think about kind of listening to the variety of voices in the sex working sphere and kind of your place in that as someone who does feel a lot of autonomy and feel a lot of choice around the work that you're doing?
Well, sex work is definitely an umbrella term for all kinds of people that choose it. And so I think that listening to all the different voices of the individuals who do choose this is extremely important, because there are so many different types of people that choose sex work. I come from a place of privilege in the spectrum. So I'm not a survival sex worker. I don't live job to job. I don't have anybody else to support but myself. I also have the kind of education that has allowed me to do this kind of work while I was being educated. And so I have a background in the kind of education that it does allow me to also express myself artistically and creatively through my sex work as a dominatrix that is creating these like kind of fantasy-based experiences for other people. And so, you know, the spectrum of sex work of course expands to people who have been trafficked, who have been sexually violated, who still choose sex work because it allows them to kind of recontextualize the experiences that they are having through this work, where they are the ones that are in control. They are the ones calling the shots. They are the ones choosing their clients. And then, of course, there are people who are doing survival sex work who, you know, because of SESTA, FOSTA, Shuttering, Backpage, and all these other places where we were able to connect and build community and screen, survival sex work is of course, you know, based in survival, like needing to pay the bills, needing to put food on the table. And it's still work, and it's still very dangerous when it's criminalized and we have no recourse for when somebody does violate our bodies or our, you know, our spaces. And so it's, you know, it's a very large spectrum of different kinds of people that engage in sex work. And so knowing all the different nuances and stories that people tell, I think, is something that will humanize us as sex workers.
We're going to continue this conversation after a break. You mentioned SESTA, FOSTA. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but some recent policy changes that have influenced how sex workers can be on the internet, what they can advertise, and what websites they are allowed to use. So much more conversation about that just ahead on Embodied. Please stay with us. This is Embodied, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. A quick content warning for today's conversation. We are talking about the shootings in Atlanta, sex and sex work. If you prefer to listen later, the show will be archived at embodiedwunc.org. When sex workers are being abused, harassed, and targeted, they can't always just call the police for help. The gruesome attack on three massage parlors across the Atlanta area has raised important questions about the safety of those in sex work and reminds us how these communities are often criminalized and targeted. Racism and sexism create additional barriers for some in these communities. Six of the eight victims in Atlanta were women of Asian descent. I've been talking with Dia Dynasty, a professional dominatrix based in New York. And joining us now is Elizabeth Nolan Brown, a senior editor at Reason and the co-founder of Feminists for Liberty. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And if you're listening along with us, be sure to add your conversation, your voice to the conversation, Embodied WUNC on Twitter and Instagram. So, Elizabeth, as we were setting up with Dia, there's a lot that we don't know about the folks who were murdered. We may never know whether they identified as sex workers. And there are a lot of sex workers who've responded to the shootings with stories of their own feelings of vulnerability. But you have said in your reporting it's really important to stop focusing on whether or not the workers in those parlors were sex workers. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think it's been really troubling to see a lot of the media covering this sort of both immediately leap to this idea that these women who worked there were perhaps sex workers or even perhaps sex trafficking victims, and then therefore say that we need that was what put them in danger and that we need more police to solve it. Because all of these things are sort of repeating the logic of people that put these workers in more danger regardless of their circumstances. You know, you have a lot of people like the shooter in this case, and like we've seen, you know, so many males who commit violence against women sort of blame women for being sexually available, whether or not they're sex workers, and sort of say that they need to be held accountable for that and act like that justifies violence. So I think in the first place, you know, saying, oh, these women were sex workers and making that like it's a central factor really sort of perpetuates that distorted logic of people who commit violence. And then, you know, the idea that we need more cops to go in there and crack down in case they are sex workers is just especially damaging because, you know, across the board, people are put in more danger by this sort of criminalization. I see a lot in my research that government officials and local police and the FBI and Homeland Security are often involved in these sorts of things too, just sort of assume that anyone working at Asian massage parlors is either involved in prostitution by choice or by force, and they respond accordingly by sort of surveying these places, by sending in undercover cops to do stings, and that has its own problems. You know, you're sending in cops to get sex acts from people possibly that you're calling victims. But in general, all of this just makes it much harder for the people who are working at these places to come forward when there is trouble. Because regardless, again, of, you know, of their circumstances, the fact that they're going to be assumed to be breaking the law or to be at a place that is breaking the law means that very often they are not believed by police, or that maybe they are believed by police, but that isn't the end of it. Like, I've seen cases where women who work at massage parlors have actually come to police and said, like, look, this person is stalking me. This person is vandalizing our place. And police have taken their testimony and used that to put away the perpetrator. But then after that, they've also targeted those massage parlors for prostitution stings and further law enforcement action. So it's like they want to treat the people there as both victims and criminals a lot of the time.
So there is this conflation in a lot of conversations of massage parlors being spaces where sex trafficking is happening. And we've seen this massive uptick in the past decade of raids of these spaces, of headlines, you know, about the outcome of these raids. I'm curious about what you've learned from your research on the data. How much, what are these raids actually doing? What are we uncovering about whether or not there is trafficking in these spaces?
Yeah, you know, if we look at any of the high profile ones in recent years, like, you know, the one that got attention at Florida massage parlors that involved Patriots owner Robert Kraft, there is one that Senator Josh Hawley says that he was involved in, that he busted up a sex trafficking ring in Missouri when he was attorney general there a few years ago. So if you look at those, or if you just look at any story in the news, I've done some analysis just sort of, you know, measuring over a certain period of time, anything that said massage parlor sex trafficking in the news, and then I followed up to see what happened. And in almost none of these cases has there ever been anyone charged with human trafficking or sex trafficking. What you almost always see is the workers at these places end up being charged with prostitution if that is taking place, or if not, they'll be charged with anything that they possibly can, like building code violations or working without a license. It's sort of just, you know, you have these big splashy headlines that go, and these big splashy investigations where police say and prosecutors say, we're going in there to save human trafficking victims. And then in the end, they just use it to sort of target the very people that they're trying to save with whatever sort of crimes they can, and then seize their assets. That's another huge component of this, is you often see police departments seizing assets from these people that are working at the massage parlors.
I want to play a clip from a vigil held March 18th by Red Canary Song, which is a collective of Asian sex workers and allies. And this is Elaine Lam of Butterfly, a Canadian Asian sex worker support group.
We always need to ask how many vigils we need to attend. How many funerals we still need to attend? That is not something we really want to do, but we have to do, because the society do not listen to the community. They know how to fix the problem, but they still continue to harm this community because of their moral agenda, because their anti-sex work idea, anti-migrant idea, and their racist idea. So if we say the perpetrator is used a gun to kill the people is also killed by racism. The people is also killed by homophobia. the people also killed by sexism, the people also killed by the state, by the law enforcement, police, and those NGO they claim to rescue the community, and but actually they are anti-sex worker.